We're going to begin our third essay in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 8 through the first verse of chapter 11. We are going to be looking at the first part of this, the third essay, the entire chapter of 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And this is specifically in regards to food offered to idols. Now, this is part of issues that were raised by the Corinthians and sent in a letter to receive a response from Paul. The first issue that they wrote about, that they asked Paul about, was marriage, divorce, and the circumstances around it. What was allowed, what was disallowed. The second issue was in regards to the betrothed and widows. Well, so what, can they remarry? Do they need to remain single? That sort of thing. And now food offered to idols. So there are different outlines here. The English Standard Version Study Bible, the outline is the three issues from the Corinthian letter from chapter 7 through the first verse of chapter 11. In the commentary reading the New Testament series, this section from chapter 8 through the first verse of chapter 11 is under the heading, The Limits of Christian Freedom. And then in Paul Through Mediterranean Eyes by Kenneth Bailey, this essay is under the heading Freedom and Responsibility. And so this first part of this essay introduces the topic. In the next part of the essay, Paul is going to use himself as an example of freedom and responsibility in the Christian life. And then he's going to go on to discuss three ways in which Christians can identify with the world to practice freedom and practice responsibility. First is full identification. The second is partial identification. And the third is no identification. And Paul, in the very last part of this essay, returns to the topic that the Corinthians raised, food offered to idols. And so we're going to read through this chapter 8. And I'd like to kind of mention that Paul uses satire and irony in his writings. Sometimes we think Paul is just pretty boring or pretty serious in everything he writes. Well, not really. He employs satire. He employs irony to get people's attention.
What satire?
Sarcasm.
Satire is kind of poking a little fun.
Political mockery?
Yeah, mocking.
And irony is?
Irony is contrasting two very different things. Ironic speech. They're kind of related. They're both used in humor, comedy.
Irony, you're stating a concept or an ideal and contrasting it with someone's behavior or something like that.
When they're not in...
When the two are very different.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can do it anything else.
So Paul begins. Now, concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know, but if anyone loves God, he is known by God. Therefore, As to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence, in that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you, who have knowledge, eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? And so by this knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. So what do you think the issues are?
Allegiance.
What are the Corinthians asking about? What's the issue for the Corinthians?
Food offered to idols.
What's the issue for Paul?
Somebody else's idea of what you're doing.
Your influence on others.
Yeah. What is Paul, what do you think Paul is exhorting in this response to the Corinthians' concerns?
Consideration. Consideration for other people.
His first sentence was, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up.
Mm-hmm. Be kind to one another.
So if you're arrogant to say, I know there's nothing happened when this was offered to idols, you know, I can eat it.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who sees me. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm.
So, how do you think this passage might apply to us, the 21st century West, Western Christians?
Oh.
Appearances. Mm-hmm. For us Adventists, it's just in reverse.
We're so full of knowledge and all puffed up, and we need to get deflated.
We also have different standards than we used to, than we were raised with. And so someone might see us acting differently than we were raised to act. And think that we are defiling our faith.
Well,
and they might therefore feel defiled. If our faith affects them, they might feel defiled.
But when I,
or even betrayed.
When I visit in their church and their turf, I speak conservatively and I keep my peace. I don't speak as I speak here.
Right.
I think it's
on toothpaste.
being conservative, being considerate of other people. And if you are attempting to be considerate, you might even get a little close. But, you know, still we hurt people's feelings or raise their eyebrows or, you know, whatever. But
when I'm down south, I avoid, and I'm at potluck, I avoid the meat. When I'm here at Baker, I search out the meat.
Because he knows he has to overdo it for my sake.
No, you don't want to offend him. You can offend either way. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So
the question keeps coming back to me with the very first.
Mm-hmm.
You said this was in response to a letter written to Paul from the Corinthians.
Yes.
Where is the letter that was written to James in Jerusalem, and what was James's response?
Paul didn't write James.
I know Paul didn't write James. What I'm saying is, this is Paul's response, but the head of the church was in Jerusalem.
They probably
had a different viewpoint.
Well, not necessarily. There was no central church.
Well, I thought Paul went down to the central church to give them permission to preach.
No, Paul is clear in his writings that he needed no permission.
Right.
He simply went to obtain their blessings because then it would be more acceptable to the Jews that he went to.
Right.
Did they give it?
Yeah.
With some...
This is... Yeah. I'm not entirely sure where this fits in with the Jerusalem Council of Acts 15.
Okay.
1 Corinthians is considered one of the earliest letters.
Okay. So, unsure whether it was before or after the Jerusalem Council?
I don't know offhand.
Okay. All right.
But what I am thinking is, we just spoke here about liberalism, conservatism within our own church, mm-hmm. and different groups, and I dare say that existed then too.
The Adventist church.
The Jewish Christian Center was in Jerusalem.
Right.
The rest of the Christian Center was in Antioch of Syria.
And they probably had different comfort levels.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. Yeah.
And then once you get closer to, you know, like Corinth, the kind of that area, then you would have a different center. Paul resided in the area of Ephesus and Corinth for quite a bit of time during his journeys. So Paul, Apollos, Priscilla, Aquila, they would be considered kind of the leaders of that area, of the of that northern Mediterranean, Italian.
Of the church in that area, they were the leaders.
There were...
The Macedonian area.
Okay.
There were feelings that were alive about should you or shouldn't you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he's addressing.
And what I'm thinking is, they're on the forefront of the interface, where Jerusalem, there probably would have not been this type of interface at all.
No, because all of the... It was predominantly Jewish Christians.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, what sorts of assumptions might we right now be reading into this passage?
Quite a few, I don't doubt. But what are they? Because I don't know.
Well, food offered to idols, what? No.
What did that mean to them?
Well, what does it mean to us right now?
Very little, because we don't know people that offer food to idols personally anyway. I mean, I don't.
What about the term knowledge? What does knowledge mean to us?
Knowledge to us means a whole lot. And when it says knowledge puffs us up and all of that, well, we like our knowledge.
Bookman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, knowledge is a very important thing in our culture, as I suspect it was in theirs.
Oh.
Jewish, very much so.
Yeah.
What about food offered to idols? What? Why do you think it? Why do we think it's wrong?
I don't think it's wrong.
Yeah, in this culture, I don't think we much care.
So we are more of the what's here in Cameo 3 verse 4. Well, we know that an idol has no real existence, so who cares?
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I mean, if we are offering food to an idol with the intention of giving allegiance, that would be different, but we don't. If we were to do something like that for some reason, it would be part of a ceremony that is very traditional in a culture that's different than our own. Such as in Japan, there might be something like that. There might be something where you, well, I don't remember food, but there are ceremonies in Japan where you offer things to...
Did you buy a toaster last week, and was it made in China? And did it get manufactured by child labor?
I did not personally. No.
Is that the same issue? If we're boycotting child labor, companies that use child labor or not, personally, I have not.
Oh, would that be a similar issue as refusing to eat food offered to idols? As in, refusing to acknowledge or benefit from something that you disapprove of?
Right. Some people, that's more... To me, I haven't really...
That hasn't become
no,
an issue.
No, but I do know there's people that will not do certain things because of the the labor source or the...
Is it only by fair trade?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And so when I'm in their jurisdiction, I try not to...
Right. And that makes sense. And that's something to definitely be respected.
So that does bring up a question. I am being very cavalier about it, but maybe I know that I am selling nickel iron batteries, thousands of dollars worth of nickel iron batteries, and they're only manufactured in China, predominantly because China does not have the environmental regulations that the United States does, and they don't have, which includes personal protection of the employees.
Well, almost all batteries of any kind are made in China.
For that reason. And manufacturing a battery is not exactly high on the health list. So am I wrong in selling a battery that is promoting hazardous work environments? Is that the question?
I don't know.
That could be a question.
Well, maybe. Let's go on. What about this? The word conscience. What do we think conscience means?
What is right and wrong for you?
Mm-hmm. Since I can turn it off, I don't...
Personal interest.
That's what it is.
The things that we know we ought to do.
Okay.
Or ought to avoid.
Sure.
Personal interpretation of right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the point. I don't have a problem buying nickel iron batteries. But maybe I should.
You have a problem with a lot of other things, though.
I have problems.
But to us, conscience is a personal interpretation of right and wrong. And to them, maybe it wasn't a personal interpretation.
Not true.
Okay.
It's collective.
So let's continue. Let's go on to looking at the first three verses here a little more closely. These first three verses deal with the concept of knowledge, love, and God.
Uh-huh.
And the theme is love is more important than knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And genuine knowledge is the experience of loving. But it begins with food offered to idols. That's the concern of the Corinthians. Okay, that's what they asked Paul about. Can we eat food offered to idols?
And he says that knowledge puffs you up.
So let's get into what are the issues? Why are the Corinthians so concerned about food offered to idols? Well, this is taken from Reading the New Testament series. Is it? Yeah. In pagan cults, there were two kinds of sacrifices. First, there was private sacrifice. Mm-hmm. This was the kind that was done by the individual or families.
Yeah.
The animal was divided into three parts, a token to be burned on the altar, a portion for the priests, and the remainder used by the worshiper for a banquet,
right,
usually at the temple of the god to whom the sacrifice had been made.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Second, there was, in pagan cults, a public sacrifice. This is civic religion.
Right.
You know, when the city or a guild might choose to offer sacrifice for some kind of festival, typically. The animal was again divided into three parts, a token to be burned, a share for the priest, and a substantial amount left to the magistrates. What they did not need, they sold to the shops and markets for resale to the public. Pagans eagerly purchased such meat. Such food was prohibited to the Jews because it was tainted with idolatry. It was not slaughtered in the proper way, and tithe had not been paid on it. So instead of calling this meat sacrifice for sacred purposes, hierothuton, Jews termed it sacrifice to idols, idolothuton.
So it's not kosher.
Right. So the question is, could a Christian buy or eat such meat? So what this points out is that there were two issues, major issues. First, meat eaten at a pagan temple. The second is meat sacrificed in a ritual and then sold in the public markets. Both are issues. Which one does Paul have in mind for this chapter and for this essay? Scholars are divided. Some think it's primarily about meat eaten at a pagan temple, based on what comes in verse 10. Verse 10 reads, "For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple."
Oh, I see. Right.
Others think, too, meat sacrificed and then sold in the public markets for the public to purchase.
That kind of makes more sense.
Because of the Greek word used, idolothuton, which is found in this chapter, except for the specific eating at a temple found in verse 10. Gordon Fee, in the New International Commentary on the New Testament, the first epistle, makes the argument that although both issues are present, the primary one is number one, eating at a cultic meal in a pagan temple.
Okay.
Now, even if it was, you know, about meat sold in the marketplace, even if that was the only consideration for this chapter, it would still cause a split between the Jewish and Gentile Christians. So it is an issue. So the point here is we don't have to say definitively it's one or the other. Because both are issues. Also, kind of related to that is a third issue. The few times the poor would have any meat to eat would be during the temple feast, when the market prices of meat would drop.
Mm-hmm.
The poor then would associate meat with idol worship.
Mm-hmm.
No, it received the blessings of the pagan gods.
Right. And therefore they are blessed by the gods.
And so the issue there is that new Christians coming in from paganism might see the surface similarities between the Eucharist, communion, eating of the flesh and blood of Christ, and their former feasts, and come to erroneous ideas.
Interesting. Being feasted by the gods.
Well, the Eucharist or whatever, that is where it came from, isn't it? We're just playing paganism. It's just kind of putting a Christian swoosh. Are we talking about animal meat or are we talking about food?
We are talking about animal meat, generally.
So Adventists have a whole other set of baggage to add on top of all of that.
Why?
It's like, just be a vegetarian and skip the whole thing.
Yeah.
I kind of relate it to whatever you do, don't be offensive. And it could be being a vegetarian, like me.
No, that last one about the Eucharist, I'm confused. Because that is where I am. Because the Christian rituals that we hold. Okay. Okay. The Christian rituals that we hold, to me, are often rituals that have...
I think their roots are from paganism.
Yeah, and I think we're fooling ourselves.
So would Jesus, if he knew somebody at one of these things, would he go into a pagan idol church?
Would he go into a temple and participate if that was the culture that he was entering?
In what occasion would you want to go into a where they're worshiping idols?
Well, I don't think that was the question. They didn't go into participate.
Well, he said half the people.
Just a minute. Okay. They went into the restaurant to eat. It's a restaurant.
Yeah. It was the ancient equivalent of a restaurant.
So they didn't. They weren't participating in the ritual. They're just eating at the restaurant.
Yes. Yeah. The question is, Corinthians are asking, so can we eat
at the restaurant,
which happens to be located in a
pagan... It'd be like going to Keto's Cave.
Pagan temple.
But there's no other... That's the only mode. In the olden days, would you ever go and eat in a Keto's Cave tavern? The olden days, the tavern was the only restaurant. It was the only hotel. It was the only place of lodging. It was it.
The pub.
Yeah.
That
roadhouse.
There was. I've eaten. It's good.
She's wandering. My feelings are hurt.
Let's continue. So, is Paul does not respond to the concern immediately. He goes into what seems like a off-topic tangential digression on knowledge and love. What Paul does is he appears to quote the Corinthian assertion, all of us possess knowledge. The key word here is possess.
Are they saying we all know that this is meaningless, so why not go ahead and...
We all have opinions.
No. We all possess knowledge. The key word is possess. It's different from we all know.
Oh.
See, in our minds, we all know and we all possess knowledge may sound very similar. But this is referring to kind of a early form of Gnosticism. Proto-Gnosticism.
Uh-huh.
Where more knowledge, possessing more knowledge, means a person is at a higher spiritual plane of existence.
That's Christianity today.
Possession to be cultivated and coveted.
Now, one of the spiritual gifts is knowledge. The Corinthians were making the spiritual gift, gnosis, the end of spirituality, rather than the means to the end. Of knowledge as the means to some other end, which was, in Paul's mind, is to build up community.
And they're saying the knowledge is the goal.
So what Paul here is doing is he's pairing these words, knowledge and love. He's foreshadowing and building up the argument that's going to climax in chapter 13.
Okay. Yes.
The Clement in P46 manuscripts in Egypt translate verses 2 and 3 as follows. If anyone thinks he has arrived at knowledge, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves, this one truly knows. Different spin on the traditional English translations, which comes from the Western manuscripts. Paul's argument against knowledge as the vehicle of spirituality. You do not arrive at knowledge.
Uh-huh. you think you have arrived, have completed, are perfect.
Right.
Beware.
In Christianity, in genuine Christianity, knowledge is the result of spirituality, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. Spirituality is learning to love in the context of community. And so, when a person loves, then knowledge becomes available. Knowledge does not lead to love. Love leads to knowledge.
Knowledge is a vehicle. We can't arrive at a vehicle. It's a verb. We can't arrive at a verb.
And so, let's see.
So if your love drives you to learn about others, baggage, their makeup.
What makes people tick?
You know, that's a good point.
Then, if your drive for knowledge is to care and love for other people, then it has a whole different twist. Other than you are going to one up somebody because you know more than them, and you have a better.
I know you don't. I'm better.
Your traditions are better than theirs because they're more based on.
Yeah. See, so in our Western thought, knowledge is kind of this static, concrete object that you can acquire. It's what the Corinthians were inferring. Paul is telling the Corinthians and us that knowledge is contextual.
But you see, we build knowledge up to keep me pure, to keep me healthy, to make me righteous, to make me good, to make me.
So I can go to heaven.
All of the knowledge, then I will be good.
Right.
We're so very Gnostic.
Yeah.
So
what is Gnostic?
Worship of knowledge.
Worship of, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The having all the proper knowledge is the ultimate goal of spirituality.
I think Christianity is real close to that.
All knowledge.
This is what Gordon Fee writes in regards to what we've been just talking about. True gnosis consists not in the accumulation of so much data, nor even in the correctness of one's theology, but in the fact that one has learned to live in love toward all. The tyranny of knowledge as the basis of Christian ethics has a long and unfortunate history in the church, from which most likely few who read, as well as the one who writes this commentary, are exempt. Once theology is properly in hand, it is especially tempting to use it as a club on others. And in this case, it happens from the theological right as well as from the left. This does not mean that knowledge is either irrelevant or unimportant, but it does mean that it cannot serve as the primary basis of Christian behavior.
Right.
In Christian ethics, knowledge must always lead to love.
That is a paragraph worth reading and getting together.
Maybe we could print that out.
We'll it is printed out.
Put it right on our kitchen counter.
It's in here, yeah.
So that is Paul's
that's
Paul's digression on knowledge and love. Now we get to the next three verses 4-6, where Paul discusses knowledge, idols, and God. The theme of these three verses is, we know idols aren't real. Only the one God exists. Paul returns to the actual question that the Corinthians asked about, food offered to idols. And Paul, in principle, agrees that idols have no real existence and that there is only one real God. Mm-hmm. But he argues that perception also forms a subjective reality. This is from Gordon Fee in International Commentary again. In both cases, Paul does not allow reality to the gods of idolatry. What he does, rather, is to anticipate the argument of verse 7 that such gods have subjective reality for their worshippers. That is, they do not objectively exist, but they do exist for those who have given them reality by believing in them. Hence, there are indeed gods many and lords many. But Paul also recognizes the existential reality of pagan worship, and he knows that some within the Corinthian community are going to be affected by that reality. Thus, he interrupts the concession that there are no idols and that there's only one God. He interrupts the concession with the affirmation, as indeed there are many gods and many lords. He does not intend by this that the gods exist objectively. Rather, as verse 7 indicates, they exist subjectively in the sense that they are believed in.
So he recognizes that they are believed in and says...
He recognizes that they're there. It's a fact of life.
Doesn't matter if they're objective or subjective.
It doesn't matter if they actually exist.
But that person is going to throw it right back at you and say that your objective, singular God is only subjective to you. And you'll say...
Well, these are people, it sounds like to me, converts that have believed in that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now... But there's the whole thing of kosher would be a huge issue. Like they have two kitchens, they have, everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so if it wasn't prepared kosher, it's like, mm-hmm. That would be a huge issue as well.
Well, in that area, they're not converting to Judaism.
That's true.
In order to be Christians.
But I would fare to say that they were dragging a lot of that along.
Mm-hmm. They probably were, yeah. But
I mean, when this sheet comes down and it says kill and eat, and it's like unclean food. But I mean, that's not what he's talking about. But still, it's like, are you kidding?
Right.
So Paul affirms the Corinthian position, at least the writers of this letter. The letter that reached Paul, say, I agree there are no idols. Idols are not real, and there's only one God. However, what is a subjective perception also needs to be considered. And then in verse 6, he appears to incorporate what may have been an early creed. Yet for us there is one God the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Now this can also be read, yet for us there is one God the Father, from whom are all things and we are His, and one Lord Jesus Christ, by His hand are all things and we are by His hand. Now why that's important is down here, there may be a connection to Psalm 95, verses 3 through 5, which read, "For the Lord is a great God and a king, and a great king above all gods. By His hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are His also. The sea is His, for He made it. For His hands formed the dry land."
Is he out in John? He's quoting poetry for scientific doctrine?
No.
No? Why?
No, he's quoting Psalm, the Hebrew affirmation of God as one and God as creator.
So is he necessarily saying that, is he stating the facts of how creation happened? Or
well, we get to the subjective reality. For Paul, that may have been his science.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's
good answer. That's right.
Yeah. Well, and that was taken for granted.
But that's not as relevant as what Paul's point is theological here.
Right.
And what's important is what he develops in his words, in his interpretation of Psalms.
Right.
the way he rewords it. Paul asserts the primacy of God and Christ over all other lords and gods. And if Paul is indeed alluding to Psalm 95, Psalm 95 speaks of one God. However, in his restatement in his letter, Paul writes that the Christian God includes both Father and Son. So if that is indeed the case, then this is probably the earliest mention of the pre-existence of Christ in the New Testament.
And the way he introduced it would explain, it makes sense.
His point is that everything belongs to God and Christ, including all foods, but more importantly, all people, because all creation belongs to God. Mm-hmm. And, as a side note, by asserting Jesus as Lord, Paul is quietly denying the cult of the emperor, because Caesar is supposed to be called is the one Lord.
So he's reinforcing all of these gods don't actually exist. It doesn't matter, but
there are lords and gods.
Paul, in this statement, is giving his basis for ethical behavior for Christians. So if from this commentary, it is common today to give a variety of other bases for ethical behavior. For Paul, and therefore for all of us who would be truly biblical Christians, there is only one ground for such behavior: the unity of God, and the fact that our existence, both by creation and redemption, is grounded in the one God, whom we serve and with whom we have to do. It is out of this kind of reality that Paul will eventually appeal to the death of Christ as being for others as well as for ourselves, and therefore that love, not knowledge, must serve as the motive for Christian ethics. Christian ethics is not based on codes of what is right and wrong. It's based on the subjective, contextual relationships that you have with one another, because they too belong to God, has been created by God, and has been redeemed by God.
And a code is something that's voted on in a private thing that says, you may now do this, or now do this.
See, we would go back real quick and quote, there is one God and he never changes. It's absolute.
But obviously life changes.
And this is saying, no, it doesn't work on absolutes. It works on subjective love.
The one absolute is love.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because God is love.
But we try to lock down codes and we can't.
We try to lock down the applications of what that love is supposed to look like.
Well, what you said about Paul quoting Psalms, that may have been subjective or objective, whatever, to Paul. In our human nature, everything that we think is objective, factual reality, in reality, may be subjective to some degree, and we haven't a clue.
Sure.
That's an interesting philosophical question, because everything is interpreted, therefore everything could be said to be subjective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the main work of philosophy is to avoid interpreting.
We get to the next set of verses, verses 7 through 10, which talks about knowledge, the weak, and God. The theme here is the weak may still perceive idols to be real, even if they know otherwise, and our actions may cause the weak to stumble. So some have not yet shed their emotional conditioning of pagan temples and gods. talking about Christians.
Uh-huh.
And here's how Bailey writes about what they might have, their thought processes might have gone. If they ate meat offered to them at a temple or bought at a market, you know, offered to idols, were they not ingesting the God into their very lives? You know, because that's kind of what the pagan ritual involved, was the transforming of meat into something that was God. Isn't that what happens at the celebration of the Holy Supper?
Yes.
They could have asked. Or perhaps the, quote, God that they no longer worshipped would make them sick if they ate his meat while refusing to worship him. So there was a real concern, real fear of the new converts in regards to eating meat offered to idols. Now, this set of passages, 7 through 10, there's a common misuse. With the passage of time, this text has produced a special kind of fallout. For example, someone whose conscience is as strong as a brick barn tries to bully the congregation of which he is a part into enforcing a particular dress code on the women of the church. Remembering this text, members of the congregation say, well, we must go along with him because he has a conscience on the matter and we must not offend his conscience. Paul's advice does not apply. This contemporary illustration is not a case of a weak conscience embedded in the heart of a new Christian who is easily led astray. It is a case of a person with a strong conscience who wants to force his ethical choices on others.
So Paul is not talking about people who try to convince you to follow a particular rule.
That he has a conscience of what others should do. Obviously, if he is a man, he isn't going to dress.
That, in the abstract discussion, is not so easy applied, but when you really went into these people, it's obvious who is this type of person versus the other type.
Oh, yeah.
Is it just a personality type? I mean, how can they help themselves?
A lot of the people do tend to say, go along with it because you don't want to offend.
After a time,
because of this passage, you kind of the weakest common denominator, except that they're not being weak, they're being manipulative.
Yeah, offending someone and the other person taking offense are two very different things. Kind of opposites, actually.
One is using that offense to their advantage,
That's on them.
Declaring their offense in order to manipulate other people,
But just
that's
the very...
interesting.
This thing about dress, a lot of times the person that dresses out of norm, whatever this norm is, there's reasons why they do. And you're only compounding the problem by addressing it, usually.
Well, maybe.
You know, just maybe. I think acceptance is way going to improve the problem if there is a problem.
Yeah.
Acceptance is going to improve it more than nailing it. It's going to probably exacerbate it.
If in fact, some sort of difference in dress is a symptom of a problem, which it may or may not be, then accepting the person is a whole lot more helpful,
Overlooking it. If you have a problem with it, get over it, because...
It's your problem, not theirs.
Yeah.
Either you're going to have to resist the Holy Spirit of being gracious to the person. If you can't be gracious, get out of there. It's like if you don't like what people do in Baker, leave.
Queen, queen, queen.
Well,
the only
in Christianity,
only thing you need to say something about is if they're doing that because they don't know what it looks like to other people. And usually they do.
Well, in Christianity, there's a lot of people saying that men are, by definition, unable to resist the wiles of the young women who dress in the fashion of the culture, and therefore the women should do everything to avoid inflaming the men, and the men don't really have any responsibility in a lot of that philosophy. And it's frustrating. I'm not saying that women should dress revealingly in church, but the idea that it is the responsibility of the woman and the man is helpless in the matter is just kind of frustrating.
It's insulting to the man.
Yeah.
And it puts all the responsibility on the women.
Yeah.
We're blonde.
Responsibility. Responsibility and the blame.
Right.
Yeah. When something happens, it was automatically because the way she was dressed.
If a woman is raped, it's because of the way she was dressed. That's the reasoning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some presidential character say something to that effect.
Someone did, yeah.
So, an ultimate Christian, Paul said he was all things to all people at all times.
I think we're getting to that in the next
yeah.
So, next week.
And ultimately, the Christian who's acting out of love could be very wishy-washy from the viewpoint of others.
You could call it wishy-washy. You could call it wishy-washy, yes.
Well,
it might be actually something very different.
Jesus was very wishy-washy, and people couldn't ever pin him down. Because he did associate with prostitutes and did not rape them. He did associate with tax collectors and didn't abuse others. He did associate with the high and mighty of the church, and so he did. So,
but he didn't become like them.
Right. He became acceptable to them, but not like them.
We're going to take a little digression to discuss the term conscience.
As opposed to all the digressions we've already taken.
We moderns think of conscience as something that is internal. Mm-hmm. An introspective look within. Something that guides an individual to know right and wrong.
Yes, that is how we think of it.
Ancients viewed conscience a little differently. It was the ability to objectively assess one's own capabilities for purposeful action.
Know your limits?
Yeah, know your limits. Some of us, I think, were here when I read from misreading scripture regarding where part of the chapter talked about conscience. For the ancients and for many non-Western cultures even today, conscience is not something that really exists as we know it here in the Western world. Mm-hmm. Right and wrong is determined by community. Uh-huh. What the community says is right, and what the community says is wrong is wrong. Community norms define what is right and wrong rather than individual sense of right and wrong, which is very difficult for us to understand.
You're right. We put the individual conscience above God.
And Paul maybe have some of that individual sort of sense of right and wrong in what he writes, but he is also writing from a perspective of the ancients where conscience is kind of not this individual sense.
Conscience is a community effort.
I'm afraid to death of the community.
We're every word like that is so different from their culture to ours. It's like, how can we understand anything?
How it describes conscience here is very similar to how the U.S. Constitution uses, or, well, surrounding documents use the term natural rights.
Yeah.
And a natural right is your actual capability to do something. Hmm. It's not. It doesn't mean you should. Mm-hmm. It just means you can.
Well, we always think you should be true to your conscience, and that's your individual idea of right and wrong.
And that is a very modern Western, modernist Western idea.
And they think that program chip is perfect. Because if you go against your conscience, yeah, you're in deep trouble. But if you always act in accordance with your conscience, you will never go to jail, you'll never do anything bad, you'll never do anything wrong.
Oh, yes, you will. You'll do a lot of wrong things.
No Western
people,
talk.
I know, but people say, God told me to talk to you. Your neckline is too low.
Oh.
And so are the Western modernist concept of sin and repentance and all of that also is tied to that very individualistic concept of conscience.
And there's a lot of responsibility that comes with having a conscience. You have to tell everybody else where they're wrong.
Of course.
Because you have to be... speak.
If you think the Native culture, for an individual to go outside of the society's community conscience, then that would be... I can see that. Just try it.
And then Paul writes, food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do.
You're kidding. I thought sacrificial week of sacrifice?
Food. Whether one eats or abstains, and for whatever reason, is objectively irrelevant to our relationship with God.
Who put that word objectively in there?
I did.
Aha, you take responsibility. But subjectively, is it relevant?
Well, so what Paul is saying is actions must be determined by love. Okay, so what we eat or choose to not eat has absolutely no bearing objectively to God whether we are acceptable to Him or not. Uh-huh. But our actions must be determined by love. That's the main principle. Thus, the subjective application, through love of knowledge, as it affects our brothers and sisters, that's what matters to God. Uh-huh. How do we treat our brothers and sisters? That's what matters to God. And if food is this issue that's going to cause a relational problem, then yes, it matters to God.
So, it's okay if you want to eat your oysters, but please suck them out when they're not there.
There's a whole thing on oysters.
Throughout this entire letter, this entire epistle to the Corinthians, the problem is with the strong, the quotes, strong.
Those who declare themselves strong?
Those who think they are strong, those who are better spiritually, trying to force their views on the weak. Uh-huh. So what's happening here is the strong may have been encouraging the weak to partake in temple feasts and also to consume meat from the markets because idols have no objective reality in asserting that this is the only true and acceptable Christian position. If you're really strong and if you want to prove that you're strong Christian, you will go to the temple, the pagan temple feasts. You will eat meat purchased at the markets.
Uh-huh. If you want to display your faith, then you will disregard.
So they were
peer pressure.
They were mistaking machismo for faith.
What was the word?
Machismo.
Hey. Macho. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
It sounds kind of like a kid daring a younger kid to drive down the road at 100 miles an hour.
It's basically bullying.
Yeah.
It's spiritual bullying. Spiritual abuse is what's going on.
That makes sense.
Paul teaches that freedom is not abstract but concrete. Real freedom is being freed from the necessity to assert only or primarily one's own rights. Knowledge alone is dangerous. What ultimately matters is that believers desire the well-being of others rather than insist on their own rights and privileges. Paul writes to the group in the community that was flaunting its freedom by insisting on their liberty. That we're free to, because we're free, we know idols don't exist. We can do what, we can eat anything and wherever. By insisting on their liberty, they made the exercise of rights their ultimate concern. Paul perceives this insistence to be a threat, for it was self-serving and short-sighted. Nowhere is such exercise of personal freedom is priority given to others over self. For the Corinthians, knowledge, meaning insight, means rights to act in freedom. Thus for them, freedom became the highest good, since it led to the exaltation of the individual. For Paul, the opposite prevails. Love means the free giving up of one's rights for the sake of others. And life together in community is the aim of salvation.
I can just see how exasperated they were when he left. He's like, he didn't tell us exactly what to do. He said we have to love. What is that?
He said
at the expense of freedom, no way. If you're going to limit my freedom, forget it.
In pretty much all of Paul's writings, when he talks about freedom, it is the ability to love one another.
And it sounds like he's almost saying that if you want to assert rights and privileges, assert the rights and privileges of others.
Yeah, earlier in the same letter,
that's what Jesus said.
Paul basically essentially told the Corinthians, don't become a slave to freedom.
Your first sentence, I loved it. Now I'm reading it. I read it backwards. Paul teaches that freedom is not abstract but concrete. I thought you said, which I kind of like, Paul teaches that freedom is abstract, not concrete. And I kind of like the other way around, because freedom is based upon love, not concrete this and this and this. So you're kind of saying, yeah. Freedom, you've got to look away from yourself, because we're seeking our own personal rights.
Yeah. Which personal rights are important, but if that is your goal,
it's not the end, especially for the Christian.
To assert your own rights, then some priorities are out of place. Well, something is misplaced.
And it's all going to get summed up in 1 Corinthians 13, where everything, love is the primary principle. Everything else is a tool to help exercise love.
The principle that everything is based on.
But in order, the Western man, and I'm talking about the pioneers of developing the wilderness, have ultimate freedom. But if you're going to have a viable community, a group, a town, a state, you have to work for the best of the group, which is going to compromise some of your personal freedoms. You can't go outside your front door at 2 o'clock in the morning to shoot your rifle. It's against the law. Well, that biases my freedom.
If they don't want you to know that they shot something, they just shoot it off every hour anyway.
So this is actually flying in the face of a lot of people's goal, ultimate individual freedom.
Yeah.
Which I'm guilty of that one.
Finally, in this first part of this third essay, Paul sums up kind of this introduction section in the next last few verses of chapter 8. Knowledge your, my brother in Christ. The theme here is the weak is our brother and sister, and causing them to stumble is to sin against Christ. Paul is basically saying knowledge applied in love can build up. Knowledge without love destroys. So again, for the Christian, the priority is not my rights, but your well-being. And wounding one brother or sister is in fact destroying the community and sinning against Christ. See, Paul has a very expansive view of Christ. Christ is not just Jesus. Christ is the church whose head is Jesus.
So Christ is the community whose head is Jesus.
So when Paul here is not talking about mere doctrinal, dietary, or lifestyle issues. It's not talking about accommodations. The weak are in actual real danger of spiritual and soul destruction. What Paul is going to get into later in this essay is, for him, demons and spirits are real. And the act of causing a weak to stumble means that they are going to revert to the influence of demons and spirits.
Which is an unbalanced mind.
As in the first essay, Paul brings his focus and the focus of his audience, readers, back to the cross of Christ. This is where true knowledge is found. See, the prime example of love. So, commentary reads, thus Paul appeals to love in two ways, even though he does not here use the word. First, the person being destroyed is a brother. Here, the interplay on love, knowledge, and building up come into clear focus. They would build up the weak by their knowledge. See, that's what the strong were trying to do. They were trying to build them up by forcing them to do things that would cause them to stumble.
Crusades. I'm going to go down to the Middle East and I'm going to bring them to Christ or kill them.
So the strong would build up the weak by their knowledge. What they do instead is tear down. Because the people involved are brothers and sisters, they must be built up in the proper way. This means no more insistence on, quote, freedom, since freedom moves in the direction of individualized existence, while love moves in the direction of community and care for others. Second, the common basis of their life in Christ is not knowledge and freedom, but the death of Christ. Their arrogance and insensitivity, which would destroy a brother in the name of knowledge and freedom, are thus contrasted with Christ's love unto death. Now, freedom is important because you cannot have love without freedom. But love and freedom at the same time work in opposite ways. It's kind of this paradox. The Bible is full of paradox. Christianity is full of paradox. This is one of them. Love and freedom are necessary.
For each other.
For each other. But our focus is to be on love, not freedom.
You have to have the freedom to exercise the love. But if you focus on the freedom, you lose the love.
The Corinthians, they were concerned with the issue of food. Food is not the main issue, as Paul sees it. It's merely an example of problems. First is the idolization of gnosis, of knowledge. The acquisition and exercise of knowledge is the most important element of Christianity. That's what the Corinthians thought. The strong thought. Their second problem was the attempt to force everyone to conform to a single expression of knowledge.
We still like to do that in churches today.
Mm-hmm. Their third problem was the insistence of one's rights and freedoms at the expense of another. And the real main issue is they fail to exercise love.
You know, those four, and then back before we talked about this Christian that had an over-aggressive conscience, and another one who was the strong Christian versus the weak Christian. If they look at their marriage, if their marriage is going to reflect the exact same interaction that they're doing with their community or the church.
Well, to an extent, the woman, if she's of the exact same thought, is not going to have a lot of strain. You know, she's in the same belief patterns as her husband.
Yeah, you're right. It might not be a good reflection.
If they were both brought up exactly the same in their families because of this exactness, you know, they might dovetail pretty good. That doesn't mean that them as a home aren't crucifying other people, but...
Yeah, you're right. I recant. It doesn't work.
You know, if they're from two really different...
In some situations, it works.
Mm-hmm. If they're from really different backgrounds, it could be really true.
But I get amazed at this whole thing, because God gave us the freedom to do all this and we'll get wrong. And He still gave us the freedom to be wrong. Mm-hmm.
But we won't let anybody else be wrong.
But we need to give each other the freedom to be wrong in our eyes, in our opinion.
Conscience.
to go against our individual interpretation.
I heard once that was the original definition of the word tolerance, allowing mm-hmm. others to be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and allowing others to be...
Agree to disagree.
I interpret as wrong.
Right, yeah.
Acknowledging my own fallibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is really going beyond I'm right and you're wrong, but I'll let you be wrong. It's saying you can be right too. It's like,
uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, I mean, in fact, I'll adopt your rightness because I can see that there's value to that.
Yeah. Seeing the value in another person's interpretation.
That there's validity to
there. As opposed to... Here, you've got one group of people trying to say, we've got this new interpretation. Wow, everybody's going to follow it. Look at us, aren't we so smart?
So not only will I accept that you have a problem with that, I won't do it either because then I mean not verbalizing it, but just going that direction so you don't.
And not just because, oh yeah, you're weak, I'm gonna avoid hurting you. But
there's validity here.
Recognizing the value in someone else's thinking.
Oh, we love to tell people who are, I'm the strong and you're the weak. I've heard that.
Oh yes. We see that in church.
You know, if a pastor knows that he has to deal with each of these four elements every day of his life, he would never become a pastor.
So, now some final thoughts here. So, how do you read and interpret this passage now? Has it changed in any way from when we read it right at the beginning?
Well, it's interesting that there's two different things that scholars think they're talking about. You never knew that.
Well, Well, and it changes from the contrast between the strong Christian and the weak Christian to something different. In some situations, the strong Christian might be the one with a new progressive value that goes against the traditions or the moral values of the group. And you need to see both ways.
I don't know if Jerry was going to say this earlier, but it was Queen Elizabeth, I think, that said it. She said, if you have to tell me that you are a lady, you're not a lady. Mm-hmm. And if you have to tell people that I'm really going to love you, well...
I'm going to love you despite yourself. Then maybe that's not love you're saying?
Maybe you missed the boat.
That reminds me of the phrase from the Bible, speak the truth in love. Whenever you hear that said to you, you know that what's going to come is not loving.
In love. Absolutely. It's the sledgehammer raised to bane.
The one I was going to quote, I don't know which queen it was, but she was in a poor person's house and they did something weird. And rather than embarrass, she did that weird and everybody followed suit and did that weird, whatever it was.
And it became the fashion?
I don't know. But in other words, the hostess, who's the higher one, rather embarrassing the lowly one. One movie we had is the host poured milk into a saucer, so the guest poured milk into a saucer, thinking that that was an English custom to drink out of a saucer, but then the lady fed it to the cat.
He cheekily drank it out of his saucer.
But there was some story where the queen actually did something that was unusual, and she followed suit with her guest in order not to.
The guest did it unusual, and the queen followed
suit. Right, and she followed suit, yes. Yeah.
And that's what we should be doing more of,
oh,
and less of the other.
And we might err on the kitty side once in a while.
But is that okay now?
To err on the kitty side? What's okay?
To be wrong. What they're doing and miss the point entirely.
Be human.
It kind of tells me also that if you see someone doing something that seems like they shouldn't be doing it or something, but they're acting like it's all normal, maybe they know something you don't.
Well, possibly.
You know,
maybe you should try to figure out where you're actually going with it.
That you're saying, maybe you should try it.
You might be judgmental of the situation.
In some situations.
In some situations.
If it's actually objectionable, maybe you should try to figure out where you're going with it.
It's hard here because what Paul is dealing with specifically is something that he truly believes is going to cause the loss of someone's soul.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, which is not the typical controversy that we have in churches today.
Right.
Well, we are.
Well,
we
you
think
know,
about it.
If we thought about it, wounding somebody in no matter what can lose their soul. I mean, it can be a cascade of events or just one event that,
well,
you know.
I remember back in our old church, there was a young couple that started coming to church. They didn't dress like Adventists. And I remember the older ladies accepting them and loving them and then concluding that the time has come now. They should start dressing like Adventists. And so a lady took them out shopping and bought them proper church clothes, and they wore them to church and got lots of compliments and felt like this is the way they're supposed to act now, and the way that they came in is no longer accepted. And I don't think we saw them much after that.
Hmm.
So that would be silver dinner.
It's like, at first, their way of dressing was okay for a while because they were new, but now they're supposed to start dressing like him. And it was really kind of frustrating.
That's what I like about the church Rome's going to now.
Mm-hmm. You can be accepted even if you don't look or act exactly the way.
Right, and a lot of the old members that have been there for a long time dress casually in church, and some of them dress up.
Well, you might dress like a traditional Adventist, but there's a difference between dressing in the traditional manner and expecting everyone else to do so because it has become a moral absolute.
Right. A lot of people dress in the traditional manner there, and a lot of them don't.
And that's where you can be accepted.
Food, whether one eats or abstains, and for whatever reason, is objectively irrelevant to our relationship with God.
And it's not irrelevant to the relationship of the person sitting next to us to God.
That's right. And we need to recognize that.
Yeah.
Well, it may not be irrelevant to the person sitting next to us. And that's okay.
And I can.
So that, I think, brings us to a kind of this last paragraph. The real concern of the passage, 1 Corinthians 8, needs a regular hearing in the church. Personal behavior is dictated not by knowledge, freedom, or law, but by love for those within the community of faith. Everything one does that affects relationships within the body of Christ should have care for brothers and sisters as its primary motivation.